such as current or former CEOs, putting women's steady gains in jeopardy, Spilsbury said. 4 in 10 Russell 3000 companies have two or fewer women directors. Because women remain underrepresented in CEO roles, that approach can narrow the pathway for women. At the same time, the broader DEI environment may be making some companies less public or less intentional about diversity, Spilsbury said. With boards appointing fewer women and fewer members overall, the timeline to reaching gender parity could get longer. And finally, Equilar projected in 2025 that Russell 3000 boards will be half female by 2044, 5 years later than it projected in 2024. Between 2019 and 2022, the projection was 2030. My concern is that board diversity could regress at the exact moment companies need broader perspective and stronger oversight, Spilsbury said.
Pepsi, Tylenol among brands seniors trust. The author is Jessica Bryant. Scan the QR code for the rankings of brands most trusted by senior citizens. From discount movie tickets and special shopping perks to free gym memberships, America's older Americans have their pick of benefits from hundreds of brands. But what are the brands they trust the most? To answer this question, USAA has partnered with Plant A Insights Group to create a first ever ranking of USA Today's brands most trusted by senior citizens, 2026. Determine which brands have earned senior confidence. Plant A considered more than 20,000 of them. It then surveyed more than 6,000 individuals age 60 and older between September 2025 and October of the same year. Beverage brand Pepsi, medicine brand Tylenol, and pharmacy brand CVS all rose to the top, each earning 5-star ratings on this year's inaugural list. All 350 ranked brands are familiar to or trusted by seniors. USA Today has also collaborated with Plan A on two other most trusted brand rankings in 2026. Brands most trusted by parents, brands. Consumers of all age groups want to trust where they shop, but studies show that older Americans are uniquely brand loyal and much more sensitive to product affordability. This means that many of the brands on their list offer discounts, loyalty programs, and additional benefits. To ensure the integrity of this list, any brand involved in recent consumer data breaches or publicly reported employment-related allegations over the past 2 years was excluded from consideration. Plan A used a media monitoring platform, Onclusive, to identify these companies. The final results were then reviewed by both Plan A research team and USA Today editorial team to confirm accuracy and consistency. Interesting.
The FDA said throw away recalled eczema cream. Staphylococcus aureus was found in the treatment. The story is by Saman Shafiq. An ointment cream used to treat eczema and other skin conditions was recalled as it was found to be contaminated with Staphylococcus aureus, the Food and Drug Administration announced May 12th. Wisconsin-based company Pharmacol issued a recall for multi-symptom treatment and cream and skin protectant eczema cream sold under the brand name MG217 for being potentially life-threatening for users. Use of the product could result in a range of infections from localized to severe or life-threatening adverse events, the notice on FDA's website read, adding, quote, patients with weakened immune systems or compromised skin, such as those with wounds, burns, or skin disorders, are at increased risk for serious infections. Wisconsin-based company Pharmacol issued, a recall for multi-symptom treatment cream and skin protectant eczema sold under the brand name MG17. However, Pharmacol has not received any reports of adverse events related to this recall so far, according to the notice. What eczema cream is recalled? The cream, which is advertised as, quote, hypoallergenic and safe for children and babies, end quote, is a full-body skin protectant moisturizer offering, quote, fast, long-lasting relief from itching, irritation, dryness, roughness, redness, and cracking, end quote, according to Pharmacol's website. It was sold in 6-ounce tubes with product code 5106 UPC 01-2277-051067 and lot number 1024088 with an expiration date of November 2022. It was sold nationwide to wholesale, retail, and online market, including Amazon.
You're listening or reading of articles from USA Today for the 18th day of May on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We'll return for more readings after this short break. Your readers today are Tom Scanlon and
David Hayes.
If you're listening to this publication online, you're probably using our website, a podcast player like Spotify or iTunes, a streaming service like Siro, or a smart speaker. Did you know that we now have a dedicated app that can be downloaded to any mobile device, like a smartphone or tablet, for free? App users can conveniently access our live stream and any episode of our podcast easier than ever. To download the app, just type NFRRS in the search window in the Apple App Store or in the Google Play Store. Contact us anytime if you have any questions by calling 716-821-5555, extension 5. Thank you.
We'll continue now with our reading of articles from today's edition of the USA Today. We will start in the sports section. Your readers today are David Hayes and
Tom Scanlon.
Spurs are young but court savvy. Lorenzo Reyes authored this article. Perhaps it's the presence of veterans like De'Aaron Fox and Harrison Barnes. Perhaps it's just the organizational culture cultivated by longtime coach Greg Popovich. Either way, the San Antonio Spurs play well beyond their age, which makes them dangerous, not only for years to come, but in these NBA playoffs. For most of their key rotation players, this postseason is constantly bringing about new firsts. Victor Wembanyama, Stefan Castle, Dylan Harper, Devin Vassell, Julian Campagna, Keldon Johnson, and Carter Bryant, four of whom are starters, are playing in their first playoffs. This was their first conference semifinal appearance. The last round was their first round series, and so on. Yet the Spurs were the team that played with more poise. They stayed out of foul trouble and didn't complain to officials. They embraced grit and hustle plays. Their effort and intensity didn't dip Most important, they didn't let the magnitude of the moment get in their head. In Game 6, the number 2 seed Spurs thumped the number 6 Minnesota Timberwolves 139-109 in an absolutely dominant performance, one noteworthy for the way this young team is playing. Second-year guard Castle erupted for 32 points and 11 of 16 shooting, including a blazing 5 of 7 from three-point range. Castle added 11 rebounds and 6 assists. The Spurs exploded in the second part of the game, 6 clincher, outscoring Minnesota 20-0 to start the period and forcing the Timberwolves to miss their first 12 attempts. The bigger reason the Timberwolves went cold is because they didn't do a good job of coaxing Wembanyama out of the paint, leading to Minnesota being hesitant in there. The Timberwolves would respond with a 27-11 run, but by the time they started going at Wembanyama, forcing him to contest their penetration, it was already too late. And finally, San Antonio played loose and confident. The Spurs have an identity, one built on defense, speed, and attacking the paint that's built for the postseason, and they can win in different ways. Although they'll have to get through the reigning champion Thunder, they did go 4-1 against Oklahoma City in the regular season. The rest of the West should be concerned because this team is built to be very good for a very long time.
Here's another NBA article. Holmgren is OKC's MVP in playoffs. Dateline Oklahoma City. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was set to be named the NBA's MVP for the second year in a row on May 17th. Deservedly so. He's even better this season than last. The voting won't be particularly close. But here's what makes the Thunder such a load. Through two playoff rounds, Gilgeous-Alexander hasn't even been the MVP on his own team. Chet Holmgren has. As the Thunder and Spurs embark on an epic Western Conference Finals series starting today, the play of the respective 7-foot-somethingers will be critical. Holmgren isn't the key for the Stone Thunder the way Victor Wembanyama is for the Spurs, and the Slendermen might not even guard each other. But if the Thunder gets round 1 and 2 version of Holmgren against the Spurs, hard to imagine anybody, alien or otherwise, beating OKC 4 times over the course of 7 games. Because this is a version of Holmgren we haven't seen, not in the playoffs at least. It helps when you're not hampered by the lingering effects of a broken hip, as Holmgren was last postseason, despite playing in all 23 of the Thunder's playoff games. "You never feel perfect," Holmgren said May 15th. "If you do, that means you're not out there hitting hard enough. You're not playing hard enough, so there's always bumps and bruises. I can visibly see them." Holmgren chuckled. His red fleece jacket concealed the playoff scars. "There's a big difference between bumps and bruises and what I was going through last year," Holmgren added. "I'm not dealing with any of that stuff. I'm not just trying to get myself out of there for games. I'm really able to prepare and focus on the game more so than my health. It's a blessing. You can't take it for granted." It's been 17 months since number 7 landed hard on his hip at a home game against the Golden State Warriors. He sustained an iliac wing fracture, which sidelined him for all but 32 games last regular season. Holmgren, back in time for the playoffs, averaged 15.2 points, 8.7 rebounds, and 1.9 blocks per game in OKC's title run. Pretty darn good for not being at the peak of his powers, for having broken his hip that season. A year later, Holmgren's averaged 18.6 points, 9.1 rebounds, 1.8 blocks per game in the playoffs, shooting 60% from the field, 39% from three-point range, 89% from the foul line, way up from his playoff splits, 46-30 and 78 last year. The Thunder outscored the Phoenix Suns in Los Angeles Lakers by 82 points in his 251 playoff minutes. A.J. Mitchell, who's a team best plus 136 in the playoffs, has stepped up in the absence of Jalen Williams as the Thunder's number two scorer. But Holmgren has been the Thunder's second best all-around player and arguably their MVP. With Jay Dubout, the second best player title, inane as it is, might belong to Holmgren even when Williams returns. The myriad ways in which Holmgren is better than he was 12 months ago is lengthy. Just seems like he's around the basket more, Thunder coach Mark Dagenau said. He's finding more cracks. We're finding him more. His decisiveness on the perimeter over time is smooth. His shot-driven reads, his ability to move the ball quickly. And then we've talked about this a lot, but his versatility defensively, his ability to be impactful at the five, at the rim, and also on the perimeter, has unlocked a lot of options for us. The list is long, but it should be for a guy that's as impactful as he is. So lastly, but it all started with Holmgren's health, the foundation on which all these skills are fortified. I just felt a lot more calm and settled, Holmgren said. I know what I'm trying to get to.
Now switching to baseball, the Brewers' second baseman soars to, quote, one of the best in the world, end quote. Milwaukee Brewers' second baseman Bryce Turang is the black and white reel amid today's brilliant cinematography. In a world filled with celebrity attention seekers, Turang is a gray Ford Taurus in a lot filled with Bentleys. There is no marketing on his social media account. There are no notable sound bites and interviews with the media. He doesn't have his own podcast, and never does he open his soul to anyone but close friends and family. He's simply a grinder who may be the best all-around second baseman in the game. Quote, he could have played in any era, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, you name it, end quote, Brewers manager Pat Murphy tells USA Today Sports. He's not looking to impress you with his flair. He's definitely not a, quote, look at me, end quote, guy. He's not looking for attention. He's a team guy. He loves baseball. He just loves preparing for the game and playing it. He's really special. It's all legit, bro. You want a glimpse of Turang? Check out the first walk-off homer of his career with two outs in the ninth inning on Mother's Day against the Yankees for a 4-3 victory in front of a sold-out crowd of 40,000 people at American Family Field. The place went bonkers with his 411-foot shot cleared the center field fence with teammates screaming and jumping over the dugout railing to greet him. Turang's reaction, he just dropped his bat, rounded the bases with no emotion, methodically high-fived third base coach Matt Erickson, and stepped on home plate. When he was doused with a bucket of Gatorade by teammates, he looked almost annoyed that his cap got wet, then spoke for a brief minute on the field. How did it feel hitting his first career walk-off? Yeah, it felt good, he calmly said. Got the pitch I wanted and drove it. So it always feels good, and feel even better when the team wins. Not exactly riveting, but that's Turang, who gets more giddy finding a local gas station that just dropped its price of unleaded fuel. Nothing shakes this guy. When MLB Network unveiled its ranking of the game's best second baseman this spring, Turang was ranked 10th. It was laughable, bordering on absurd. You're talking about a guy who won the Platinum Glove Award as the best defensive player in the National League in 2024, a guy who finished 14th in the MVP voting in 2025, a guy who hit .288 with 18 homers, 81 RBIs, and a .794 OPS last year, leading the Brewers to the National League Championship Series. Turang saw the rankings and didn't utter a word. He's having the best offensive season by any second baseman this year, hitting .297 with an MLB-leading 4.1 on-base percentage and .21 OPS, 6 homers, 7 RBIs, 33 runs, and 8 stolen bases. He opened the season reaching base on 21 consecutive games, the third longest streak in franchise history, and in the last 2 weeks is hitting .375 with a 1.087 OPS. He has been the metronome for the Brewers' success in a season in which sluggers Christian Yelich, Jackson Quaro, and Andrew Vaughn have played a combined 34 games. Terang has played and started in 39 games, almost refusing to ever come out. He played 3 or 4 games he shouldn't have with a sore ankle, Murphy said, but he gives you that funny look if he's not in there. He wants to be in that lineup every single day. He's not just the best second baseman in baseball, Brewers shortstop Joey Ortiz said. I think he's one of the best players in the world. It's not hyperbole. If you go back to last August, Terang ranks as the 4th best player in the game, according to Fangraphs, with a 4.8 WAR. He trails only Dodgers 3-time MVP Shohei Ohtani, Yankees 3-time MVP Aaron Judge, and Royals shortstop Bobby Witt. He's one of my favorite players to watch in the game right now, Judge told Milwaukee reporters last weekend. He's going to be a bright young star in this game for a long time. He's one of a kind, man. I wish we had him on this team. Judge and Terang were teammates for three weeks during World Baseball Classic, where Terang stole the show, hitting .364 with his 8 hits, 4 doubles, 5 RBIs, and a .931 OPS in the 6 games. Terang left his Team USA teammates gushing about his skills, saying they knew he was talented but hadn't fully fathomed his all-around greatness. I learned so much from that experience, Terang said, understanding what makes them great. These were some of the most respected guys in the game, and they were so cool helping me out, learning how to go about your business, the mental side of it, the routine, and competing, said Yelich. You could see the difference. He came back far more confident for sure. When you're on a team with those kinds of players and you fit in, it does a lot for your confidence, and confidence is a big part of this game. He's always been a talented player, but he's turned himself into a great player. Terang, 26, grew up in a family with his dad, Brian, playing outfield for the Seattle Mariners, and his mom, Carrie, playing softball at Long Beach State. He has 5 sisters who are collegiate softball, soccer, and volleyball players. His brother-in-law, Tress Way, punts for the Washington Commanders. He has always had a quiet, burning confidence, but rarely exposes it. When he was drafted by the Brewers in 2018 with the 21st pick out of San Diego High School in Corona, California, they were $1 million apart in negotiations at the outset. Terang, who had a scholarship at LSU waiting for him, offered David Stearns, the Brewers' president of baseball operations, a little advice. You're going to let $1 million stand in the way of signing a Hall of Famer? Terang asked matter-of-factly. Terang, with less than 24 hours left before the deadline, agreed to a $3.4 million signing bonus, nearly $400,000 over the slot value. And the Brewers had their future star. Terang reached the big leagues in 2023, and the Brewers have won the NL Central every year since his arrival. With a 26-7 record this year, they are prime playoff position again. They opened their biggest series of the season May 18th against their hated rival, the Cubs, at Wrigley Field, sitting 1.5 games behind Chicago. Really, it's a similar predicament to a year ago when they were 6 games behind the Cubs at this point, only to win the National League Central by 5 games. Just to prove they were the superior team last year, they knocked off the Cubs in the NL Division Series with Terang hitting a home run in the 7th inning of the deciding game of the best of 5 series in a 3-1 victory. Quote, I remember him coming to the dugout after his second at bat, Murphy says, and he says, Murph, I'm right there. I'm just missing those things. I don't know. I'm missing it. The third time up, Terang crushed a 416-foot homer over the left center field wall. And with the stadium shaking, Terang came calmly back to the dugout and said, that's it. I told you I was right there. In the meantime, We'll see if this year's Traegs finally gets his due and is on the national stage in Philadelphia in 2 months with his first invitation to the All-Star game. And finally, forget the personal stuff, Traegs says. I want to be a good teammate. I want to stay on the field. I want to win. That's all I ever wanted. Just win every single day that I can.
You're listening to reading of today's USA Today and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The time is 16 minutes after the hour. We turn now to a very short article about the sport of kings. Napoleon Solo wins Preakness at 7-1. The author is Jason Frakes. Napoleon Solo won the $2 million Grand Preakness Stakes at Laurel Park, giving trainer Clad Summers his first victory in a Triple Crown horse race. Been a lot of trials and tribulations along the way, Summers said. I almost quit about 3 or 4 times. Been forced to retire a few times. But we're still here. We're still battling and got the victory done on a horse we bought for $40,000, which I love the most. Ridden by Paco Lopez, Napoleon Solo covered the 3/16 miles in 158.69, paid $17.80 on a $2 win wager. Iron Honor finished 1 1/4 lengths back in second, and Chip Honcho was third. Taj Mahal set the early pace, 22.66 seconds for the first quarter, 44.66 for the half, and 112.08 for the three quarters, with Napoleon Solo racing just behind in second place. He broke perfect and followed them around, Lopez said. There's a lot of speed in the race, and he was patient till it was time to move. The distance and everything was right for my horse today. Napoleon Solo took the lead entering the stretch, held off Iron Honor. I had a good trip, Iron Honor jockey Flavian Pratt said. I thought he had a good chance. He was traveling well and turning for home. I thought I was going to be able to make a move on the winner. I just couldn't get by him. Napoleon Solo entered the Preakness off a fifth place finish in the Grade II Wood Memorial on April 4th at Aqueduct in New York. Napoleon Solo, a gray son of Liam's Map, improved to 3-0-0 in 5 career starts for owner Al Gold of Gold Square LLC. Napoleon Solo was 2-for-2 as a 2-year-old, including a victory in the Grade I Champaign, but finished 5th in both his starts as a 3-year-old. I felt like I did a disservice to him all year long, Summers said. You know, fifth place. Everybody said he wasn't good and he wasn't in the Champaign. This was a win here. People say it wasn't against the best of the best. We'll find out the rest of the year. Summers said Napoleon Solo will point toward the Grade I Haskell on July 18th at Monmouth Park. How we get to the Haskell, we'll find out, Summers said. The Preakness was held at Laurel Park in Maryland as a renovations at Pimlico Racecourse in Baltimore. Attendance for the race was capped at 4,800 fans. There was no Triple Crown on the line as Kentucky Derby winner Golden Temple skipped the race. Trainer Sherry DeVoe said Golden Temple is being pointed toward the Belmont Stakes on June 6th at Saratoga.
The time is now 20 minutes after the hour. Getting back to basketball, NBA Western Conference Finals, picking the edges in Thunder versus the Spurs. This article is by Justin Martinez. The Oklahoma City Thunder will face the San Antonio Spurs in the NBA Western Conference Finals. Number one seeded Oklahoma swept the number 4 Lakers in the second round. Meanwhile, number 2 San Antonio earned a 4-2 series win over the number 6 Timberwolves. Oklahoma City and San Antonio face each other 5 times during the regular season, including 1 game in the NBA Cup semifinals. The Spurs won that series 4-1. Here's a complete breakdown of the Thunder-Spurs matchup. The backcourt starters. San Antonio has one of the best backcourt duos in De'Aaron Fox and Stephon Castle. Both players are aggressive attackers on offense with great speed and athleticism, and both players are disruptive on defense. But floor spacing is a weakness for Fox and Castle, who both shot exactly 33.2% from deep during the regular season. Then there's Oklahoma's duo of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Lu Dort, who should move back to shooting guard now that Jalen Williams' grade 1 left hamstring strain is expected to return. Gilgeous-Alexander is one of the most unguardable scorers in the NBA, while Dort is one of the league's best defenders. The winner of this category could change on a game-to-game basis, but I'm giving the edge to Oklahoma City. Gilgeous-Alexander is that dominant of a player, and Dort has played his role well this postseason as an elite defender who's shooting 37.5% from deep on 5 attempts per game. The edge goes to the Thunder. Front court starters. Speaking of Williams, the All-NBA forward has been out since April 22nd due to a grade 1 left hamstring strain. But he said during a YouTube blog on May 15th that he's going into the Western Conference Finals, quote, healthy, unquote. Williams is a huge addition to Oklahoma City's front court, which already has an imposing duo of Chet Holmgren and Isaiah Hartenstein. Holmgren has shined this postseason as the floor spacing forward with an improved ability to play through contact, while Hartenstein continues to serve as a strong rebounder and a skilled passer. But San Antonio is one of the only teams in the NBA with a better front court, and it's mostly because of one guy. It's because of Victor Wembanyama, a 7'4" freak of nature who can deter drives with his elite rim protection and cause problems on offense with his unmatched blend of size and skill. Just like the backcourt, the winner of this category could change depending upon the night. But Wembanyama is also that good, which makes me give San Antonio the edge, despite only having a solid surrounding front court starters in Devon Vassell and Julian Campagna. The edge goes to the Spurs. Bench production. This series will be a battle between two of the deepest teams in the NBA. Oklahoma City's bench is headlined by Ajay Mitchell, a breakout sophomore who should return to a backup role with the return of Williams. The Thunder also boasts elite defenders such as Alex Curasso and Carson Wallace, plus knockdown shooters such as Isaiah Joe and Jared McCain. San Antonio's bench is led by the Sixth Man of the Year winner in Keldon Johnson, who is the heart and soul of the team. The Spurs also have a young breakout guard of their own in Dylan Harper and veteran backups in Harrison Barnes and Luke Kornet. I'm giving the slight edge to OK because it has a bit more versatility, but if you haven't noticed a common theme between these evenly matched teams, the winner of this category could fluctuate. The edge is going to the Thunder. Coaching. There's a reason why Mitch Johnson is a finalist for Coach of the Year in his first full season. San Antonio surpassed expectations going from a team that many picked to sneak into the playoffs to one that kicked down the door. And while his talented roster deserves plenty of credit, some of the recognition should also go to Johnson for coaching an elite defensive team that's fundamentally sound. Mark Dagano also deserves credit for his continued success with OKC. His ability to push all the right buttons could clearly be seen this season as the Thunder finished with the best record in the NBA despite facing injuries to numerous key players. I'm giving the edge to OKC since Dagano has experience as a head coach on the stage while Johnson doesn't. Edge goes to the Thunder. And then there are the intangibles. Records in the regular season series don't mean everything, but they definitely don't mean nothing. San Antonio's 4-1 series win over Oklahoma City was impressive, even if you don't count its final win on February 4th. That was a 116-106 home victory over a Thunder team that didn't have all five of its usual starters. What you can't forget is the way the Spurs won those games when both teams were mostly healthy. The way their guards got past Oklahoma City's elite perimeter defenders and into the paint with ease. The way Wembanyama's shot blocking made finishing around the rim feel impossible. I believe experience will help the Thunder win this series in 7 games, but there's no denying that there's something special about these Spurs. And one final thing, they're a real threat to dethrone the reigning champs. Edge goes to the Spurs.
I think this will be the last article in the sports section, and it's also on basketball, but this is on women's NBA basketball. Mercury rookie Nojic putting a league on notice. The author is Sydney Henderson. Dateline Phoenix. Nate Tibbetts can't recall watching a player smile while shooting the ball until Serbian basketball player Jovana Nojic was signed to the Phoenix Mercury after being scouted overseas. "As long as she's smiling, it keeps going in," Tibbetts said May 15th, after Mercury picked up their first win at home on his 49th birthday. "She's an elite-level shooter. She has fun while she's doing it." Nikos has a lot to smile about lately. The 28-year-old rookie is off to a historic start and recorded 4 or more 3-pointers in 3 of her first 4 games in the league. That includes a 27-point outing in Phoenix win over the Chicago Sky on May 15th, where she went 5 for 8 from deep and set a WNBA record for the most points by an undrafted rookie. "It's just fun being out there with my teammates," Vujic said. "I really just try to enjoy the moment because this is, I thought, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for me." It's not every day you get to play with players like Alyssa Thomas, just letting the game come to me and have fun. Last week, Alyssa Thomas said Mercury wouldn't be overlooked as contenders if everyone was familiar with the elite players Phoenix brought in. Well, the cat's officially out of the bag about Nojic. With Monique Ikoa-McKinney overseas and Sammy Whitcomb recovering from a procedure on her left knee, a unique opportunity opened for Nojic to make her mark in the starting lineup. She did so immediately with 19 points, 4 for 5 3-pointers, in her first start in Phoenix, 99-66 dismantling of defending champion Las Vegas Aces. The performance was even more impressive considering she only had limited practice time with the Mercury before her WNBA debut. After winning a Russian title in late April, Nogarek arrived in Phoenix in May ahead of the season opener and had to travel to Vancouver to get a visa the next day. "When I got back from Vancouver, we were flying to Vegas for the first game. That's why I couldn't practice with the team as much," Logic said. But she proved her performance wasn't a fluke. She scored 4 more 3-pointers in Phoenix's loss to the Golden State Valkyries, the second game of a back-to-back on the road. She came off the bench in Phoenix's 88-84 homecoming loss to the Minnesota Lynx, scored only 2 points, 0 for 6 on the field goals, 0 for 2 on 3-pointers, in 17 minutes as team started to adjust in game plan for her. She had 2 big games. She's on the scouting report. It's going to be nights where people go after her, challenge her, and speed her up, Tibbetts said May 14th, adding a day later. "That's the fun part of coming into the best league in the world," said. "People start to recognize your strengths and how can we slow you down?" But she's a confident player and one of the best lead shooters in our league. With each game, Nojic's comfort has grown with her teammates, the team's terminology, and its system. She slid back into the starting lineup against the Sky, dazzled the solo crowded mortgage matchup center with no-look passes and threes. She shot 6 for 11 from the field, 5 from 8 from 3, and 10 for 11 from the free throw line. Nojic's 64 points through her first 4 games marks the 3rd most by any rookie in franchise history, according to the Mercury, trailing only Diana Taurasi with 83 and Cappy Pondexter with 85. When your coach gives you confidence to shoot it and you have the freedom to shoot it, it makes your job a lot easier as a shooter, Nagic said. But her shooting isn't the only thing that's impressed her teammates. Her improvement on the defensive end is what I'm most proud of, Tibbetts added. Nagic said the team's defensive identity and toughness were impressed upon her as soon as she arrived in Phoenix, which has stuck with her. First time that I got here, Sammy Whitcomb was on the sideline, and the first thing she told me is, Thomas doesn't care if you miss it. She cares if you play defense, she recalled on May 15th. Nagic doesn't have anything to worry about. Her defensive performance was approved by Thomas. I mean, she's Serbian, so you know how they play defense, Thomas said. Played against her, I know what she's about. I'm very familiar with her style of playing. Just very excited to have her here. I think it's players like this that get overlooked and missed. And I think she's been doing amazing things overseas. So just super happy for her to have this opportunity. Thomas added, she's more than ready, and that's what's great about Phoenix. They go find players that have talent, that have been overlooked, and bring them here. And I mean, people are surprised when we have players come and shoot the way they do. But that's just a credit to our staff. Phoenix has created its own niche in scouting and international gems from overseas. Looks like the Mercury's front office has done it again. You're listening to a reading of today's USA Today on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And the time is 33 minutes after the hour. So we turn to the life section of USA Today.
We will start with a comment on streaming. Quote, Punisher, end quote, goes deep and dark, end quote, last kill. The story is by Brian Truitt. First, a warning. This story contains light spoilers from Marvel's Disney Plus special. Joe Bernthal's latest round as the Punisher couldn't have been more personal. For a decade now, Bernthal has deeply explored the anti-heroic character of Frank Castle, who started a one-man war on crime after the murder of his family in a gang shootout from Netflix's original, quote, Daredevil, end quote, series to his own show. In, quote, Punisher, Last Kill, end quote, Frank wrestles with the psychological toll of his brutal actions and sees his murdered daughter, Lisa, again, played by Bernthal's own 11-year-old child, Adeline. The actor hadn't seen his family for a while during pre-production and filming until a tough scene set at Lisa's gravesite where dad and daughter reunited. It was in a pretty dark, emotional place. I'll be honest, Bernthal tells USA Today. Quote, I pop my head up at the grave and she's standing right in front of me. We designed that to have as much emotional impact as it could. It was such a joy to share it with her, end quote. Co-written and directed by Ronaldo Marcus Green, quote, King Richard, end quote, One Last Kill puts the Punisher through the ringer, emotionally and physically, like never before. Ignoring the extreme chaos around him in a crime-ridden neighborhood, the former Marine is haunted by the ghosts of fellow soldiers. Frank contemplates ending it all. Even his mob matriarch, Magnucci, played by Judith Light, also wants him dead after he killed her entire family. A lot of Punisher stories move past, quote, the spiraling, whirling madness and darkness of trying to avenge his family, and he had become this sort of crime fighter, of proponent for justice, unquote, Bernthal says. Quote, I understand the need and desire to get him there, but I really wanted for the fans to see it happen in real time. So instead of moving him forward down the line, I wanted to bring him back and show what it was like really at rock bottom, unquote. Bernthal is close with a group of veterans and found inspiration in Nip, Camulatos, one last kill producer who also appears in the special. He had a story that was similar to Frank's as far as hitting a low point and quote, going to take his own life and what happened to get him out of it, end quote, Bernthal says. I was really intrigued with the idea, if only one way you know how to honor the dead, to honor the people that you miss so deeply, is to go and kill their name. And what happens when there's no one left to kill? With Frank's severe emotional isolation, Bernthal crafts him as, quote, this unreliable narrator. He's really cracking and he doesn't know what to believe anymore, end quote, the actor says. Quote, the result is a very fragile version of Frank where he can't even trust himself until he's caught on fire and all of a sudden he hears a scream from next door. That reminds him of his daughter's scream and boom, he's in action, end quote. Green also was affected by hearing from ex-soldiers who experienced what Frank is going through. It's heartbreaking when you see these big, strong men who get choked up or who hold on to the Punisher in that way. It's beautiful. Frank ultimately has a crossroads moment in One Last Kill. Instead of going after Mon, continuing to be that version of the Punisher, he instead runs to help a young girl save her father from violent goons. We knew in our heart which decision he was going to make. Having the audience decide is the most important thing, Green says. He makes the human choice, which is in part who Frank is, and getting back to the core of his psychological state. Bernthal, who is starring on Broadway in, quote, Dog Day Afternoon, end quote, and features in The Odyssey, which will show up in theaters July 17th, would love to come back and do more Punisher specials, but fans won't have to wait too long to see his skill be decked armor again. Frank's next Marvel Cinematic Universe appearance is opposite Tom Holland's web-swinging hero in Spider-Man Brand New Day, out on July 31st. Tonally, it's going to be much different, obviously, but it was important to me that the same character could walk off one screen and walk onto the other, and hopefully we were able to achieve that, Bernthal says. For Bernthal, the Punisher is a character who is a symbol to put your wounds to use, put your pain to use, he says. The ultimate goal with the Punisher is to get Frank to, quote, a place where he can be the kind of person you want to show up when there's something bad going on, end quote, the actor says. And finally, some of these folks that are capable of the deepest of stakes and people who have suffered the biggest of wounds are also capable of doing the most good. This article discusses suicide and suicidal ideation. If you are someone you know is struggling or in crisis, help is available. Call or text 988 or chat at 988lifeline.org.
This next article is a streaming review. Netflix Films outlines impact of fatal crash. The author is Aaron Jensen. There's a spoiler alert. This story contains details from Netflix documentary, The Crash, including the outcome of Mackenzie Shirley's trial. Gareth Johnson, director of Netflix's new true crime documentary, The Crash, was drawn to the story's fatal car wreck as soon as he heard about it. At 18, Johnson was a passenger in a deadly car crash that took place in 1992, shortly after graduating high school. Of his injuries, his three shattered vertebrae required the longest recovery time. In the hospital, I could see the ripple effects of the crash that I was involved in on my family and friends and people around me, he tells USA Today. I always felt like I kind of had the easier ride because it was so traumatic for those around me. When you heard about Mackenzie Shirley's collision, highlighted in the documentary, which is now streaming on Netflix, he was interested in understanding the flip side of my experience. Around 5:30 a.m. on July 31st, 2022, 17-year-old Shirley rammed her Toyota Camry at approximately 100 miles an hour into a brick building on Strongsville, Ohio. The impact killed her boyfriend, Dominic Russo, age 20, seated in the passenger seat, and their friend David Flanagan, age 19, riding in the back seat. Shirilla's defense team said postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS, which can cause fainting, caused the teenager to pass out at the wheel. In the film, Shirilla claimed she had no memory of the event. Yet law enforcement believes Shirilla acted intentionally and charged her with multiple counts of murder. Though she pleaded not guilty during the 2023 bench trial, a judge found Shirilla guilty of all charges. She was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison. Here's what's to know. Shirilla and Russo had a turbulent relationship conveyed by filmmakers through volatile messages and videos. "I'd watch your back from now on," she once messaged him, "and your house and your car and your life." Assistant prosecutor Tim Troop said 2 weeks before the crash, Russo phoned his mother, Christine Russo, asking for help as Shirilla drove erratically and dangerously. Family friend who intervened said he heard Shirilla threaten to crash the vehicle. Shirilla's mom, Natalie Shirilla, later disputed this recollection of the events by presenting text messages to filmmakers in which Shirilla asked Christine to pick up her son after he allegedly tried to grab the wheel while she was driving. According to Troop, first responders found marijuana in Shirilla's purse and psilocybin mushrooms on her person. Toxicology report later found THC in Shirilla's system, but no psilocybin or alcohol. Troop doesn't believe impairment caused the crash. Another notable discovery was made by Ryan Fox, a sergeant with the Ohio State Highway Patrol, who says the recording system in Shirilla's car logged approximately 5 seconds of pre-crash data. During that time, the gas pedal was pushed to the floor and no one attempted to brake. The data show that around 3 seconds before the impact, there was some steering input, Fox said, right movement, left movement, and then a hard right movement. It shifted from drive into neutral, back into drive again. Troop believes these were attempts by Russo and Flanagan to stay alive. Police arrested Shirilla on November 4th, 2022 and charged her with numerous crimes, including multiple counts of murder. Shirilla then opted for a bench trial, which means the case was presented to a judge without a jury. Shirilla was tried as an adult during the proceedings that began on August 7, 2023. A week later, on August 14, 2023, Judge Nancy Margaret Russo convicted Shirilla of all charges, including the murders of Russo and Flanagan. Shirilla morphs from a responsible driver to literal hell on wheels. She makes her way down the street, Russo said, using video footage from the crash to inform her verdict. She had a mission and she executed it with precision. The mission was death. Shirilla did not testify during the bench trial, but chose to read a statement at her sentencing August 21st, 2023. Through her tears, she apologized to Russo and Flanagan's families while maintaining her innocence. "I hope one day you can say I would never let this happen or do it on purpose," she said. Judge Russo ultimately sentenced Shirilla to 15 years to life for Flanagan and 15 years to life for Russo, to be served concurrently. Shirilla is imprisoned at the Ohio Reformatory for Women, about 130 miles from Strongsville. In March, Ohio's Court of Appeals denied Shirilla's petition as her team filed one day past the 365-day jurisdiction deadline. She is eligible for parole in 2037. It took a while for Johnson and producer Angard Scott to get an interview with Shirilla in prison, especially since she hadn't been interviewed by police before or after her arrest. During their hour-long interview, the filmmakers set out to ask the hard questions, pressing Shirilla on her lack of memory of the crash and the belief that Potts could be to blame. It's obviously been months and months of work, so we're all in, Scott tells USA Today. There was a nervous energy in the room. She felt like her voice had never been heard, and she'd never been able to put her side across. And he got the sense that she wanted to really use this opportunity to do so. Toward the end of the interview in the film, Shrill is asked if there's anything else she'd like to add. Turns to her attorney for guidance. I don't want to force anything and just say too much or sound crazy, Shrill says. Just want to make sure that I'm big on the no intent. There was no intent whatsoever there. I have excessive amounts of remorse for Dominic and Davian and both of their families. So it's not intentional. I will do everything I can to prove that to the world and the families. It's a moment that may make viewers question the integrity of her remarks. Johnson finds Squill's curiosity about how she's coming across understandable given her appeal. I think she wants to make sure that she's gotten certain points across, that she felt strongly that she wanted to communicate, Johnson says. From our perspective, it's up to the viewer to judge whether she's being sincere. I think that's the essential question. And lastly, in the last paragraph, Mackenzie knows that every single piece of footage that she's ever produced, Dad Scott, anything that she's ever said, been scrutinized and is out there. We saw that in the trial with the way her social media was used. Who thinks she's someone who's very self-aware and conscious of how people might interpret her words and her actions.
You are listening to a reading of today's USA Today on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The time now is 48 minutes after the hour. Next article will be about the movies. Barker is ready to feed, quote, chainsaw, end quote, obsession. The article is prepared by Brian Truitt of the USA Today. When he was 11, Curry Barker had a life-changing moment watching the opening sequence of 2003's, quote, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, end quote, and one that created a new obsession. A disturbed hitchhiking girl is picked up by a group of friends in a van. She shoots herself in the head and the witnesses scream, freak out, and wonder what to do next. Watching his first horror movie was an adrenaline rush that, quote, affected me so much, end quote, says Barker, now 26. Like that really messed me up for some reason. I'd like it and wanted it again. Barker likely will mess up the next generation of youngsters now that the writer and director has been tapped to direct a new, quote, Texas Chainsaw, end quote. But before that, he's got an original work to frighten audiences, quote, Obsession, end quote, which is now a movie in theaters. A modern and completely unsettling take on the monkey's paw tale that's been picking up buzz since premiering last fall at Toronto Film Festival. Focus Features brought the independent movie out of the fest and horror tastemaker Jason Blum joined as an executive producer a couple of months later. I can't believe people are likely already so in love with this movie without seeing it, Barker says. He's already been sent a picture of one person sporting a tattoo of the, quote, One Wish Willow, end quote, the throwback trinket that's a character in itself. It's crazy. The movie hasn't come out yet. The film stars Michael Johnston as Bear, an awkward young guy who's long harbored a crush on his co-worker, Nikki, played by Indy